In this introductory page, I have identified three words which present three general areas for our consideration that ought to guide our thinking in this general subject of what is referred to as the logismos, the tempting thought of what I've translated as gloominess, which is more often translated as sadness or sorrow. As we'll see as we go over this, the reason for my choosing the rather inelegant English word gloominess is the fact that for the monastic authors, this temptation, this tempting thought, involves an act of the will, a willing cooperation on the part of the individual who receives it that then creates a state with which the individual continues to cooperate. And it seems to me that the word gloominess is the only English word that provides a sense of a state that one can actively cooperate with, choose to be in. Perhaps another form of it might be to describe a kind of a funk, to be in a negative state that one continues to reanimate or reactivate with negativity. This is the presumption of the monastic authors, but the word they use to convey this image has been translated in a variety of ways and is most often translated with the rather more general term sadness or sorrow. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that those terms reflect something that happens to you, not necessarily something you cooperate with or choose to continue or to maintain. So it's important, as we look at the different terms that I've chosen to focus on in this initial page, it's important that we have in our background, awareness, a sense that we want to try to have a sense of the monastic tradition that is concerned not so much with sorrow as an experience or as a natural and normal and even important human phenomenon, but as a problematic thing if we choose to embrace it, continue to deepen in it, and make it a habitual state. And I've chosen to focus on three words at the very beginning, to look at the original Greek philosophical and then the biblical senses of these terms, because they come up not always in the monastic primary sources we'll be looking at specifically, but in the broader spiritual tradition. The first is the generic term lupe, which means sorrow or sadness, but more specifically it refers to grief or distress or pain, mental or physical anguish. The second term, aischune, refers to shame, disgrace. This will be important not so much in all the sources we'll be looking at, although it will come up once in Evagrius, but in particular when we look at modern reflections on this dangerous and destructive state of negativity. Sometimes it can be entered into or believed in because of a false sense of shame. That is to say, I'm mistaking the self for the thing that needs to be avoided or the thing of which one needs to repent. And Dr. Gerse's article on joy and shame will bring this out in particular. So that's why we're going to look at this term initially. And the third term is penthos. And this term will primarily come out not in the sources we'll be looking at directly, but it comes up regularly in the later mystical tradition, particularly in the Eastern Church, as a way of describing holy sorrow, the proper use of sadness, the thing that one should cultivate in one's own spiritual life in order to be not to be proud, in order to have a profound sense of dependence on God. The term penthos is used especially in the Greek tradition in association with the Jesus Prayer, and Bishop Callistos Ware identifies it as being an absolute prerequisite. If there is not an emphasis on penthos, it is not the Jesus Prayer. Well, we'll come back to this a little later on. Let's drop down to number one. Some general reflections on the question of gloominess versus holy sorrow. And I've already highlighted most of the points that you can read through here. Cassian uses the Latin word tristitia as a way of translating the Greek term lupe. Unfortunately, there are some authors who use the word depression as a translation. I think this is very problematic, where while on the one hand it evokes a profound state of melancholy, on the other hand, the modern use of that term refers to an illness, which is in no sense the individual's fault, which is nothing one cooperates with, but something that happens to one. And I think it's a very big mistake to use that term to describe this vice, which necessarily entails freedom of the will and cooperation. If we drop down then, to number two, the term lupe, which I've translated as gloominess in the later texts, and which more specifically means grief. Notice that in the Greek classical and philosophical tradition, lupe is the opposite of pleasure, hedone. It is the pain, the psychological or even the physical pain that has to do with not having or the avoidance of or maybe wanting and not getting particular pleasure. It can refer generally in the early tradition to any kind of pain or sorrow or anxiety at misfortune. In the Old Testament, it is used for a whole variety of Hebrew terms, and there too it indicates pain and sorrow and annoyance. And in the New Testament, lupe particularly refers to sorrow of soul. This is the sorrow of the disciples and of the Lord himself in Gethsemane, a sense of interior sorrow. It is something that is perceived as negative, but it is not morally described as being problematic in the New Testament. This is the word that is used in the early Greek monastic tradition to describe a vice, and here again we have to bear in mind that this more general understanding has to be understood in the monastic context in an extended way as involving freedom of the will. If we drop down now to the term shame or aischune, the classical Greek meaning is indeed shame or dishonor. In the Old Testament, it means to shame or to be brought to shame, and very often it is God who brings someone to shame by judging the individual. So it's the shame that occurs in the face of divine judgment. And in the New Testament, it has similar kinds of meanings, although I've highlighted in particular the sense in 1 John 2:28, where aischune means silence. It contrasts with the freedom of speech, the openness of discourse, which is present in the elect. So it's the silence that involves being ashamed, which in some sense prevents prayer, prevents the openness of exchange with God. And perhaps here we can begin to get an insight into how a false shame, an attribution to the self of profound unworthiness or of even self-loathing, is itself an impediment to prayer because the individual comes to believe that they are not worthy of speech with God. There is this ancient sense of the person who has been justified has the right to speak, and the person who has been brought to shame is in silence, brought into silence. However, as I've noted here, the cross of Christ changes the meaning of shame. The cross is by definition a shameful symbol, and yet it becomes the source of life for Christians. So there is an ambivalence to the use of this term in the New Testament as well. And we'll come back to this in particular when we look at Dr. Gerse's article on shame. Dropping down to the last term on this page, the term penthos, the root meaning is mourning, to mourn for the dead in the Old Testament. It also expresses a sorrow and grief that accompanies the prophecy of disaster. And there's also, I've associated here the term klothmos, or weeping. There is a sense in which weeping signifies a dependence on God. It's not just the external sign of sorrow, and this is important when we consider the notion of the gift of tears. It's supposed to be an appropriate response that indicates a deep relationship with the one with whom one is in communion. Weeping and penthos in the New Testament, those who mourn and those who weep, who are proclaimed to be blessed in the Beatitudes, are thus, because they recognize their dependence on God. They do not arrogantly stand in a state of believing they can be separate from God or they don't have any need of God. This deep mourning or weeping is an external symbol of a reliance on God's grace, those who know that they have to rely on the Lord. I should add parenthetically, and this will come out in the in my own article on penthos that we'll be considering a little bit later on, that the ancient understanding of tears is also a reflection of what would today be called a lability of affect, a tendency in ancient times for people to be able to move much more easily and quickly and without embarrassment from a state of quiet contemplative reflection into a state of profound mourning accompanied by tears. Our own tendency to be reserved in display of emotion makes this kind of external manifestation of devotion or piety considerably less common, certainly in Anglo-Saxon culture in the United States, than it would be perhaps in other cultures.